Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the MBPE Investor Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions for how to participate will follow at that time. During the conference, if anyone should require assistance, please press star, then the number zero on your touch-tone telephone. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Mr. Paul Daggett. Sir, you may begin.
Great. Thank you, Jimmy, and thank you, everyone, for joining today. This is Paul Daggett speaking. I will cover the business update and what's going on in the portfolio at MBPE, and I'm joined by Talmai Morgan, our chairman, to talk about corporate governance and any other issues that people wish to discuss at the end of the call in the Q&A. The presentation for today has been emailed out. Hopefully everybody has that, and it will be available on our website later today. The presentation is based on October restated numbers, and so that's October numbers updated for the information that was released in our Q3 report, which came out on Monday, and rolling through what happened in October to get us as up-to-date as possible. So I'll start on page two, which probably most people on this call know the background to MBPE, but our objective is to provide investors with the opportunity for capital appreciation through the capital gains that we look for in our private equity investments, and paying a regular income through dividends, which we pay twice a year. The strategy is to invest directly into private equity-backed companies, and we look across the capital structure at opportunities that we see from across the NB platform, which, as you can see, is $65 billion across that platform. And we believe we are one of the very most efficient publicly listed private equity funds, having lower all-in costs than most other private equity vehicles through the management fee and carry structure that we offer. On page three, just with regard to the manager, again, I'm sure people are familiar with Neuberger Berman's private equity platform. Really, the message from this page is things continue to go very well here. AUM is now $65 billion. And obviously having a thriving platform is important to MBPE, since this is where we generate the deal flow from. The primary fund business is doing very well, and because of that and because of our co-investment business, we are seeing increased deal flow this year relative to prior years in co-investments, which is obviously to the benefit of MBPE. Overall, we've been investing in private equity now for over 30 years. We invest about $7 billion annually across our private equity platform, and we have relationships with over 450 different funds, seven offices, and 150 dedicated private equity professionals. On page four is the key performance highlights for the year to date. You can see that we have a 10.5% NAV per share total return so far this year through October, and a 12.1% share price return in sterling. And on the right, one update is that the private equity fair value crossed over the $1 billion threshold during the year. We're now at $1 billion and 14 of private equity fair value. So we're pleased to reach that size. And then the cash flows have been strong, dividends we've continued to pay out, and as people will have seen, we clarified our policy earlier in this year, which I'll talk about more later in the presentation. On page five is the updated balance sheet, and again, some gradual changes here. The portfolios have grown in size, both through new investments as well as appreciation in the existing investments, and we're at 115% private equity investment level. And again, when we go back to raising the zero dividend preference shares that we did in May of this year, the reason we did that was to allow us to be efficient with our balance sheet, to be in the sort of 110 to 120% invested range, and to have that credit facility available for flexibility. And that's exactly where we are, at 115% invested, the credit facility and cash net off to about a zero. So we have that $150 million of available liquidity through that credit facility, and we're pleased with the position we're in today, with an efficient balance sheet, no cash drag, but also the flexibility to invest as and when we see fit through that credit facility. In terms of the portfolio diversification on page six, again, it's been a gradual change in certain areas. But the two things which haven't changed are that we remain most focused in the current portfolio on North America and small and mid-cap buyout companies. Again, the industry looks fairly similar to how it has looked all through the year. Technology continues to be the largest area, with industrials, healthcare, business services, and consumer discretionary all making up reasonably significant parts of the portfolio. And then on the vintage year in the bottom right, again, we have been efficient with being able to realize the portfolio and to reinvest it as we do that. And that means that 87% of the portfolio is 5 years old or less, which we see as a positive. And again, I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail in terms of why I think that's a positive and how those vintages are doing. But there is very little remaining from those older vintages, which we think is a good thing. On page seven is the NAV development, net asset value development during the year. Again, you can see there's been good gains, both realized and unrealized, in the portfolio year to date. We've also had some yield income and dividends received, that yield income obviously mostly coming from the debt portfolio we have. And then financing costs, management fees, and of course dividends paid take us to that 1805 number for the year to date through the end of October. On page eight, just to get into a bit more detail on what's going on in the portfolio and how it's performing, this page looks at the different types of investments within the portfolio and how they're performing over year to date, 1 year, 3 years, and 5 years. And you can see the direct equity investments have been performing very well across all of those periods, with the year to date number at 11.3%. It was a little bit higher through the end of September. And again, I'll come to this in more detail later, but the reason that it declined in October is through the publics that we have. And obviously the public markets have been challenging in October and November, and that leads to that small decline. But we're still very happy with how the portfolio is going and the outlook for those direct equity investments. On the income investments, which is now 14% of the portfolio, so it has declined over time as liquidations have happened, and those liquidations are not to our control. They happen either through refinancings or sales of the companies. But again, you can see over 3 years and 5 years, the numbers have been very good. The LTM and year-to-date numbers are lower, and the real reason for that, as you can see in the text box in the bottom, is that there has been one investment which has really been going through a restructuring over the last few months. That trend in that company began more than a year ago, which is why you can see those LTM numbers are lower, because that contains some of the initial markdowns we made in that position. So today, that company is marked at what we think the recovery value is most likely to be. So we hope that the impact of that has been fully absorbed in these numbers. Of course, we don't know that until it's actually fully restructured, but we have our best estimate included in these numbers. But outside of that, we're happy with how the portfolio has been going. This is the first event like that we've had in the portfolio, and over the long term, as you can see, the income portfolio has been a very strong driver of returns based on what you would expect from these types of investments. Moving on to the funds, this is now 7% of the portfolio. There's been a significant amount of liquidity from this portfolio during the year, and it's declined by about a third from where we started the year, entirely organically from realizations. So that's the good news. You can see that as it's done that, however, year-to-date and LTM numbers have not been attractive in terms of the returns they are producing. And, of course, that's why in September we did announce that we had engaged a broker to look at selling this through a broad process. That process remains ongoing. We hope to have something to announce in the relatively near future and hope to be able to exit some of these positions. I think we're really at a point now where, because you do have this drag from returns of zero or close to zero, We obviously think we could reinvest that advantageously into most likely equity investments. And if we can do that and generate the returns we have historically, then clearly a small discount would be worth absorbing at this point. So again, that is something which unfortunately we can't announce exactly where we are just yet, but we are making progress, we think. And with that, I'll move on to liquidity on page nine. And this is a chart we always show. You can see that over the last almost 4 years, we've created about $1.1 billion of realizations resulting in distributions to MBPE. Our investment pace, again, has been really based on what we're seeing in terms of opportunities. And so, obviously, in 2017, we invested a significant amount. In 2016, we were sitting on a large amount of cash and chose to invest less. In 2018, again, we are closer to being fully invested. So, of course, that has a guiding effect on what we should invest in. And that's led to a slightly slower pace of investments. But we are still seeing really strong deal flow, as I mentioned, and still seeing a lot of investments that we think are attractive. And so we are still actively investing. And as you can see, in 2018 year to date, the majority of what we have done has been into new equity investments. And talking about equity investments on page 10 is the high level summary of the direct equity portfolio. Today we have about 100 positions. I will note that a lot of those are smaller positions at this point in time, where we have escrows or positions which you know, we're looking to exit the tail end of. And if you look on the right at the top 10, then those 10 investments make up almost a third of the portfolio. So as I've mentioned on several occasions, we do like to be a little bit more concentrated in our investments, and that particularly was the case in 2017. I will say that on the chart on the right, some of those 2017 numbers are larger than last time we reported, because we have seen markups and evaluations of Staples, Material Handling Systems, the business services company, ProAmpac, USI, Engineering, and Telexius were all marked up during the quarter, and marked up based on those companies performing well. So obviously that's good news, and that has led to this part of the portfolio being even more significant in terms of its percentage of the overall portfolio. Moving on to exits on page 11. Again, you can see that it's been a good year for exits. At the top of the page are nine investments which have been sold in part or in whole. The top four are full sales. You can see that the top three were sold to private equity. The fourth warranty group was sold to Assurant for cash and stock. So we're holding some Assurant stock through that. Then the companies below are all companies where they've been taken public in prior periods, and the sponsor involved has been selling down. So these are partial sales for the most part, with the one exception being Counsel, which we fully exited. So that's those nine. And then the bottom four companies are IPOs so far during 2018. For the most part, we are still holding all of the shares in these because of lockups. So it's good to have these companies public. Obviously, the actual sell down can't really begin until those lockups expire. And of course, as well as that, the underlying sponsor needs to choose to sell. We don't control the stock ourselves in those positions. But nevertheless, I think looking at these 13 different companies, which have either been fully exited or taken public this year, we're pleased with the liquidity we continue to see from the portfolio. On that note, on page 12, again, the chart on the left looks at our realized multiple on those exits. 2017 was a particularly strong year. You can see historically it's been more in line with what we did in 2018, which is around two times our money that we've made on those equity exits. And as we've done that, there has been a valuation increase on average that's resulted, and you can see on the right-hand side, and if you look back three quarters prior to an exit being announced, then we were holding companies at a 30% premium sorry, a 30% discount to where they were ultimately exited. So again, it shows you that the valuations have been conservative over the last 4 years in those exits that we've had. So I'll move on to new investments. On page 13 is just giving some high-level points as to what we're looking for as we're making new investments. Obviously, as everybody who operates in public or private equity, valuation has been a concern to us, and so has where we seem likely to be in the cycle, which is closer to the end than the beginning, and the impact that has on what we're looking for in new investments. And so we've broken it down into two things: company characteristics and strategy. Strategy is really more focused on what we're looking for from the private equity sponsor and the management team in order to make a company successful. And, you know, I think execution risk over market risk is important to us. So we're looking for companies that depend on certain things happening in terms of the business plan for ownership to be successful. Obviously, not just looking to ride a market at this point in the cycle, so that's very important to us. On the company characteristics, you can really break down these 4 points into two things fundamentally, which is companies which are less cyclical or possibly even somewhat defensive in their nature, or companies where we expect to see strong secular growth trends even if there is a recession. So what we think are companies that can still grow in a recession. Those are the two things that we really look for in terms of company characteristics. And if you turn the page, and if you're able to look at both 14 and 15 at once, I'll just pick two companies to really illustrate those points. On page 14, towards the bottom, is a company called GFL, which is the number one environmental services provider in Canada. And so this is a waste management business focused both on industrial and consumer waste. It's a business that has been built up over time through a number of different acquisitions. Clearly, waste management, particularly on the consumer side, tends to be relatively stable through cycles. So again, we think it has good characteristics in terms of its importance to the end user through cycles. We also think there's growth drivers for this company because it remains quite a fragmented market. So we think it's a good asset that ultimately will likely be attractive to a strategic buyer or possibly an IPO as it builds up scale through more acquisitions. But as I say, we also think it happens to be a company where if there is a recession, it can be stable and then grow through those acquisitions. And so that's obviously an example of a company which we think should be somewhat less cyclical than the market as a whole. On the secular growth side, on page 15, a company called Medplast, which is the second company down. This is a healthcare-focused company. What it focuses on is contract manufacturing of orthopedic and surgical implants. And this is a business which has strong recurring revenue. It has barriers to entry because what it does is regulated by the FDA. And it's a difficult business to get into in any case because it is so important that the manufacturing is done correctly, of course. But it's also a business where we think there are secular growth drivers. And, you know, if you think about what's happened in pharmaceuticals, we have seen a very strong trend towards outsourced manufacturing of pharmaceuticals. On the medical device side, that is something which is in an earlier stage, but we do think will be a secular trend as medical device companies move to outsource manufacturers such as Medplast. And so, again, we think that this is a business that's well-positioned for that secular reason. But across the 21 investments, I think you'll see one of those three themes that I talked about on the prior page. So there's 21 investments here. Again, we're also well-diversified in these new investments, first of all, by sponsor. The only sponsor that you'll see here more than once is Francisco Partners. So again, I think it's a good thing that we're still able to bring so many different, very high quality GPs into the portfolio. It's also well diversified by industry, by company size, and by geography, with companies in the US, in Canada, in China, in the UK, in Brazil, and others, all within this portfolio. So on 16, moving on to valuations, and I mentioned when we looked at the pie chart on diversification that we think having a reasonably young portfolio can be a good thing. And again, you can see the vast majority of the equity portfolio has been invested over the last 5 years, and there's very little remaining from those older vintage years. In terms of the carrying value, the diamonds on this chart align to the right axis. And you can see that, as you would expect, 2018 investments are held close to cost. There are a couple of earlier investments that have seen small markups, so it's at a 1.1 times multiple of our invested capital. 17, some of those companies I mentioned earlier are performing very well that we did in 2017, so that has led to those companies being marked up at September 30th. Obviously, not all of the companies have been marked up, but some have. And then in 16, similarly, again, you can see that the markups have been good. So, you know, I think as we look at this portfolio, then there are a lot of companies doing well. There's also a lot of companies still held relatively close to cost. And if the original investment thesis and the management teams and the GPs can continue to execute as they have been doing, then we would hope that there can be multiple appreciation in these investments over time. But we're pleased with how they are developing so far as they've come into the portfolio. On 17 is a slide which we've added because, as I mentioned, we do have a large public portfolio at this point. Again, to reiterate, we don't control these public positions directly. They are held in co-investment vehicles where the underlying GP who made the investments controls the co-investment as well as their own investments, and those investments are sold down on a pro rata basis as and when that GP decides the timing is right. So at this point in time, you can see we have $81 million of value at the end of October. And again, some of those have been in the portfolio for a little while, like Extraction. Some are much more recent, like SolarWinds, which went public in October of 2018. You know, overall, these are companies where we would hope we'll see liquidity over the next 6, 12, 18 months, that type of time period. So we think this can continue to drive liquidity. Clearly, in October, there was a tailwind from this because they did, in general, trade down some more than others. Extraction traded down quite significantly and has also traded down into November around some company-specific issues, as well as what's been going on with the price of oil. So that one has been a disappointment, whereas others have done quite well. You know, again, we do hope that this will be a source of liquidity, and we'll have to see what happens in the public markets. Obviously, if public markets continue to decline, the chances of longer hold periods would increase, whereas if the prices improved again, obviously exits become more likely. So we've added that slide just to give that extra detail to all of you. Moving on to the income portfolio on page 18, again, this just gives the high-level summary. This is down to now 14% of the portfolio. We've described in recent calls, I think, that, you know, first of all, we've seen yields contract somewhat in this market. But I think also we've really talked to a lot of our investors and have felt that, at least at this point in the cycle and what we've been seeing, weighting more to equity investments makes sense. And so I think really a combination of those two things, most importantly, the underwriting case and where we've seen the best opportunities, but also, you know, trying to maximize in the right way the overall returns of the fund really makes sense. And so we do intend to continue to include income investments, but it has become a little bit smaller as we've weighted in recent months and years more to equity investments. So today we have 29 investments, $143 million of fair value. The top 10 investments shown on the right here make up almost half of that overall portfolio. So again, overall in the long term, this has been a net very strong positive and has allowed us to have a certain level of support for the dividend. And just to jump the gun on that, again, it's a question we get a lot, that as the income portfolio has gotten smaller, does that mean that the dividend is in any way at risk? And the answer is no. The dividend that we pay, we've always been clear, I think, that we intend to pay that in the long term. And having support from the income portfolio is definitely something we see as a positive. But even if we had no income investments, we are intending to continue to pay that dividend. So I will jump the gun on that question. On page 19, our historic performance, and again, looking at year-to-date, LTM, three-year, five-year, and since inception, and again, you can see the performance has been good. I think we need to update. There's an error on this page, but it's showing the sterling year-to-date number at 3.4%. We'll update that. Clearly, it should be higher than the NAV number, as it is over the other time periods. But the point remains that if you look at the dollar value on the NAV, because that's where most of the portfolio is in dollars, then the performance has been very good over 1, 3, 5 years. And then share price, again, we'll come to the discount, but generally has performed quite well over those time periods as well. And obviously, we are trading today in dollars and sterling, but sterling is where most of our investor base is, and so really that becomes, I think, the most relevant measure. Moving on to page 20, dividends and capital position. I mentioned that we really look to pay that dividend twice a year. We have clarified our dividend policy that we'll aim for 3% of NAV or greater. And of course, that should NAV fall, that's not intended to be a mechanism to allow us to cut the dividend. That ultimately, that's a guidance we're giving as to how we can progressively increase our dividend over time in the long run as NAV increases. Also importantly, as I mentioned earlier on the balance sheet, in terms of our capital position, we always have been, since we IPO'd this fund in 2007, very focused on having a strong balance sheet and having flexibility should liquidity stop. And again, we have 150 million of cash and available credit facility, a very low level of adjusted unfunded commitments, and all of that gives us a 300% commitment coverage. So we feel very good both about the security of the balance sheet as well as our ability to invest as and when we see good opportunities. On NAV and share price development on slide 21, and really coming to the point on discount, the discount widened a little bit this week, obviously as we put out our Q3 numbers, which showed a fairly significant increase over our previously issued September and October monthly numbers, but has been in the high teens or low 20s, and clearly the market as a whole has widened out. You know, we'll touch on this, and I'll let Talmai touch on this a little bit too. But clearly, this is something we remain very focused on. You know, I think the portfolio has been doing well. We feel the portfolio is well positioned, and so as the market has widened out, so have we. That is certainly a source of frustration, and certainly something we're thinking about in terms of investor relations. And marketing going into next year. And I'll let Talmai talk about anything else that we're thinking of in that regard. And so that completes the portfolio update. And there's one slide left, which is page 23. And I'll turn it over to Talmai to talk about the various ongoing strategic actions that remain in progress.
Thank you very much, Paul. Can you actually hear me, or do I have to do anything on my phone here from Guernsey?
Hopefully everybody can hear you. I certainly can.
Okay. I'll proceed on that assumption. Well, good afternoon, everyone. You've heard from Paul that the performance is good. But apart from that, the company has continued to engage in the various strategic actions which have been announced over the last couple of months. The first one, just to confirm that we will, of course, be delisting from Euronext with effect from the 20th of December, so that's just over a week's time. But shareholders can, of course, continue to trade on the company's US dollar quote on the London Stock Exchange. Then I'd like to say something about the recruitment of two new additions to the company's board of directors. We've had a very thorough process to try to identify these two individuals. We've been assisted very ably by Cornforth Consulting in London, who actually produced a very good quality long list of candidates for our consideration. Then in a number of stages, we reduced that long list down to a shorter list and then to a short list. Interviews were actually held in London, and various other telephone interviews also took place. The position we've now got to is that we have selected two of the candidates. And I actually think, and my colleagues agree, that these two candidates are very able and experienced individuals. And we very much look forward to those two individuals joining the board. We're just finishing off some final due diligence matters, and we'll then be able to make the announcement. Hopefully, in the course of the next week. And I think that shareholders and the wider market will actually be pleased by the two individuals that will be joining the board. So it's been a good exercise. We've done it very thoroughly indeed. And I think people will be pleased by the two individuals that we look forward to welcoming to the board. I'll be happy to take questions on this later, though clearly I cannot at this stage disclose the names of those two individuals. But we're nearly there. In relation to share buybacks, as indeed we've already announced before, the share buyback documentation with Jefferies has now been agreed. So the company will be able, and I'm happy to say that, I mean, the company will be prepared to make share buybacks in some circumstances. Shall we say, under the more normal market conditions where NBPE's discount widens due to company-specific reasons. I certainly don't think, and the board agrees, and brokers also advise to the effect that current market volatility is obviously not conducive to commencing any major and sustained buyback program. Some companies, I note with interest, are engaged in that, but I don't think one can buck the market. But certainly this company will be in a position, through having the buyback documentation not only agreed but executed and things agreed, to make buybacks in certain company-specific situations. I don't think any of our peers, with one exception, are engaging in any buybacks at the moment, and with what's happening today, And in recent times, it's not the most propitious environment in which to engage in buybacks. At least that's the board's evaluation upon advice. In relation to the secondary sale of the legacy fund investments, I think we've got about 70 odd million left, so it's not an enormous chunk now of our $1 billion private equity fair value. We have, as we have announced, been quite actively engaged in through a broker, seeing what we could actually realize from the legacy portfolio. Certain funds would not be appropriate to realize because they're coming to the end, and we expect a realization. But in relation to a number of those funds, we have actually requested the broker to get marks. I think what we can say at the moment, as Paul said, is that the matter is progressing, I think, quite satisfactorily. Progress is certainly being made. We do think it's likely that we will actually proceed to close the transaction relating to the realization of quite a large chunk of that legacy portfolio. So, again, we did what we said we would, and we hope we'll be able to make an announcement in that regard within a relatively acceptable period of time. I think those are the sort of corporate matters to which I wanted to have reference, but I'd be very happy to take questions relating to what I've said or any other related matters.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask our speakers any questions, please hit star then the number one key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may hit the pound key. We ask that you please mute your line once you've asked your question to prevent any background noise from coming through. Again, that is star, then one, to ask a question. Our first question comes from Ian Scholar with Stifel. Your line is now open.
Good morning, Paul. You put out a pretty good NAV for the end of September, and you restated the October number. And I was just wondering, give us a bit more color on the factors behind that.
Behind the good September numbers or the October number?
No, the good September number. I mean, obviously, the October number was then just a little forward. But I mean, that was actually quite a big move for that month.
It was. And, you know, I think I will just say, you know, on the October numbers, that the difference and the reason we used restated numbers is that we did want people to see that the publics are big enough and, you know, had a disappointing month. And so that's why we don't always necessarily use the following month restated, but in this case we felt it was important to and did so. In terms of the September numbers, ultimately it was really a very good performance that we've seen, particularly actually in the 2017 investments. You know, the biggest markups were there, and we had taken some larger positions in companies like Staples and USI, and, you know, another position that's become bigger because it was already doing well, MHS. Those were all 2017 investments. Those were all marked up by the underlying fund. And typically, you know, even if a company is doing well, it's unusual for it to be marked up very much in the first 9, 10, 11 months. But when the full year comes, I think it does tend to be marked slightly more to market. And really, that's what we saw, that those 2017 investments, you know, some of them are obviously only a year old, some of them are coming on to 2 years old in the portfolio, and those underlying sponsors have been able to execute. And, you know, we have obviously mentioned this a lot, but we were fairly aggressive in our investment pace, I would say, in 2017. And, you know, the reason for that is that we saw a lot of opportunities that we really felt were quite differentiated with very clear plans. And even in a difficult and competitive market, that there were value levers that differentiated them. And so far, obviously, all of these are unrealized. That has been the case. And really, that's the story that particularly 2017, but also actually 2014, 16 and 18 investments saw a lot of unrealized gains in Q3. Earlier in the year, we have seen quite a few realizations. The Q3 numbers were more driven by unrealized gains from those mostly younger investments.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Louis Margolis with Select Advisors. Your line is now open.
Thank you. I've been an investor since November 2008. I have been talking to management about repurchasing stock because of the very high risk-adjusted return. I didn't buy any the last 3 years. Economically, I don't understand it. The end of October, October 30th and 31st, the stock traded 200,000 shares at a 23 or 24% discount based on the known asset value at that point. You've had authorities over the years to buy stocks. The reason, quite contrary to what the chairman said, the reason to buy in stock is when it goes down for no corporate reason. When it just goes down because it's cheaper. I think you have that concept backwards. This is outrageous that you are not buying stock. The only logical reason for you not to buy stock at a 20% plus discount is to maintain your income on the asset. Never sold a share, bought more this year, bought stock at every integer single digit all the way up. This is immoral what you're doing.
Can I reply to that? I'm sorry, I didn't hear 100% of what you said simply because of the telephone line, but I've certainly
what
got the gist of it.
What would you like me to repeat?
Don't worry about that. I know that you've asked about this question a lot.
For 10 years.
I know. And I know that you've had a lot of conversations about it and that you do feel passionately about it. And I don't blame you. I mean, it's you with the other shareholders. It's your company. And we do actually take very, very seriously indeed what our shareholders say to us. The decision relating to, or decisions relating to share buybacks, it's an imperfect act. In the last 14 years, I've been on the board of a lot of companies, and in quite a few of those companies, we have engaged in share buybacks. Some of them have been extremely large share buybacks, where you've had long, sustained campaigns, basically. And the experience has been varied in perhaps the majority of those companies. There was an initial fillip to the share price, but it was not sustained, or at least not sustained as much as one would have hoped. In other cases, there was a more opportunistic approach to share buybacks. And in perhaps in more cases, that was successful, where sometimes you've got a relatively small block of shares, which perhaps is having a disproportionate effect on the share price. So I think it's quite effective for a company to be nimble and to gobble up some shares from time to time. The time when I think it's very much more problematic is when you have market conditions which are so volatile for a multitude of factors that if you're starting engaging in share buybacks, you're almost like an ATM, a very, very convenient source of liquidity. And I've seen companies in which that has happened.
I don't want to sound rude or impatient, okay?
No, not at all.
But there is no, on October 30th, stock traded 167,000 shares. The company bought zero. It traded it between and there's no explanation for that other than we're not doing that. Now, I'm not impatient. I've been a shareholder 10 years. I buy on a basis. This is outrageous. Looking at your rate, the company's rate of return on these various products, I have to say the direct investments have been fabulous. I have been arguing for 10 years that the stock traded a premium, but the corporate governance and the lack of buyback doesn't permit that. Wrong. It's so immoral. It's greed. It's corporate greed, plain and simple. Now, the first time in years I've been talking like this. This is outrageous.
So can I just interrupt? I'm not. I don't know if it's. I don't know if it's the case for other people on the line as well, but I'm not hearing 100% of what you say, presumably for telephone reasons.
Yeah, it's breaking up for me too.
The bit which I've got, is your passionate belief that the company should be engaging in share buybacks. Also, you did mention.
Can you hear the word? Can you hear me say the word greed? Did you hear that word?
I was about to say that I was surprised when I did hear you say corporate greed. Could you perhaps explain?
It is to maintain that? When you repurchase shares, reduces your fee. Did you hear that? That
reduces
it reduces the fee income.
So presumably you were referring to the fee payable to the investment manager being reduced.
Correct.
I see. One thing
I have a suggestion.
Say,
I have a suggestion.
Well, please come to the end of your question then, and I would like an opportunity to reply, please.
I think we should change the compensation on gain from corporate repurchase to engagement to do corporate purchases. They should not be penalized for repurchasing stock more than a 20%, which, just for benefit, generates 25% immediate return, riskless, in net asset value. There's nothing further for me to say. Please respond any way you like.
Thank you. I certainly haven't heard everything you said, but we've certainly heard your passionate belief. And as a long-standing shareholder, you know, we take it seriously. We listen to all shareholders. As Abraham Lincoln, I think it was once said, You can please all of the people some of the time. You can please some of the people all of the time. You cannot please all of the people all of the time. Nevertheless, we do take our responsibilities extremely seriously, and I happen to think that we discharge those responsibilities in a very proper fashion. On behalf of the investment manager, certainly since I've been involved with the company, since IPO, I have never seen the investment manager approach any decision except in a highly professional, highly reputable way. I have never seen any evidence whatsoever that they take their own interests into account before discharging their fiduciary obligations to the company. So I do feel that passionately myself, but I do hear the passion with which you have espoused your belief that share buybacks should take place.
We will take
your viewpoint into account together with the viewpoints of the other shareholders, because we have to do what we honestly believe to be in the best interest of the shareholders as a whole. But I do hear your question. I do hear your passion. And, you know, no one is taking you for a ride or just sort of humoring you. What you have said will be reflected upon.
Jeff, you publish the criteria, the pros and cons of corporate repurchase. The only negative that large shareholders as realistic is the reduction of fee income to the manager, the claim, which is highly controversial, that it reduces liquidity. Thank you very much.
Thank you for posing your question with such passion.
And I just wanted to add one small point, which, of course, this is all a board decision, but we are paying $26 million a year of dividends, and so we are returning capital in one form, and the debate is always the best way to return capital, not whether we should be returning any capital.
Do we have any other questions?
Yes, we do. We have a question from Charles Murphy with Panmure Gordon. Your line is now open.
Good morning in the States. Got a couple of questions. Can you talk a little bit about the assets that are in the credit opportunities investment sleeve, which is part of the income sleeve, because I've never really got a sense of what's in there? And then I'll ask the next question after that.
Yes, absolutely. Hello, Charles, and good afternoon to you. So the Credit Opportunities Program, we don't disclose the investments simply because a lot of them are positions where, you know, all of these things are in the type of income investments we make are thinly traded, if traded at all. But nevertheless, we need to keep those confidential because we don't want people to know, obviously, what we're trying to do. There's really a mixture of different types of income investments, and they're different to the types of income investments we disclose, which are primary issuance of second and first lien debt. In credit opportunities, a large part of that portfolio is in secondary acquisitions, where we either are able to buy a reasonable size position or we build up a position over time. And then there are other types of income investments in there. You know, there are certain types of PIK notes, for example, in companies which, you know, are, again, different to those cash yield investments that we make in the primary program. So for the most part, that's really what's in there. And also that's why it is one thing in the portfolio we do give a little bit less detail on.
No, that's fine. But are we talking essentially corporate credits, or are we talking different, or are we talking structured credit?
Still corporate credits.
Right.
You know, in private, they're still in private equity backed situations for the most part. So again, it's you know, it is a sort of continuation of that income strategy, and again of the statement that we look to invest across the capital structure in private equity backed companies. So again, the vast majority falls into that type of bucket.
Brilliant, thank you. Right, my next question. Actually, I've got two. I'll do the simple one first. You, about, I think possibly a year ago, you were talking about, actually, you were thinking about increasing the size of your individual investment commitment. And then this year, you've done quite a lot of small ones. Can you talk us through?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, our goal is to, in general, be more concentrated over time. And, you know, we've talked about our allocation policy. And so sometimes they're, you know, particularly in smaller companies, they're just less available. And, again, that is being allocated across our platform. So there will be situations where even if MBPE wanted 15 or 20 million, then that isn't always available. I think that's part of it, but I think also as we've gotten to a point where we're fully or close to fully invested, and again in recent months we've actually seen a reasonable amount of cash come back and the credit facility paid down. But again, you know, our choice is sometimes should we do an investment or not, and you know, if we do, do we really want to do the full bite size given kind of, you know, how much that would mean drawing on the credit facility. And so I think it's really a combination of those two things, that sometimes the full amount's not available. And secondly, sometimes when you're approaching the investment level you want to be at, we still want to participate in an investment, but we might choose to do so at a slightly lower level than we otherwise would. It's really those two things. But the overall comment definitely still stands. That you know, ultimately, when we're showing 100 positions, we would rather it be more concentrated than that. And again, you know, that would allow you to focus on investments like some of the ones we've mentioned and those top 10 investments, where you can really kind of dig in and see what's going on in the portfolio. So again, we can't say that every investment is going to be 20, but certainly, if you look back 2 or 3 years, we did a lot of investments which were single-digit million, which
yep.
we, I think, are doing less of today.
Okay. Two more, and then I'm done. Well, one of them is for Talmy. On the valuation process, you're basically taking the GP's valuations, as far as I can tell, for the co-investments. How mechanical are these processes? Or I've never quite, it changes, you get some GPs have very mechanical processes and some there's more art to it. I was wondering if you can give us any insight as to the sort of balance in your portfolio of whether there's a comp set and a fairly mechanical adjustment,
yeah.
or whether it's actually more of the art end of it.
I mean, ultimately, we use practical expedient for our valuations, and we look to the underlying sponsors as the principal guidance for our valuations. And it's quite unusual for us to differ from those. So we look at them. We have our own valuation committees. We examine them, but you know, typically we're investing alongside very high quality private equity firms who have themselves got very detailed and robust valuation policies and procedures. So that for the most part, you know, when we get those valuations in, they are well justified by the valuation methodology they might be using. And so I think if you look across our portfolio, In the vast majority of situations, we are holding things on the equity side where a sponsor might be. On the debt side, it can be a little bit different. That really, there's two things to look at. One is, of course, in debt, the first thing you do is value the overall company and see how much cushion the equity gives you. And if the equity were in jeopardy, then clearly you have to think about what would happen to the debt in that situation. But then there's also, and again, most of our income investments are performing very well, and you don't see any predicted impairment in the equity, so we're holding, again, most of them at their face value. But then there's also those situations where there are trades that we know of in some of these first and second lien positions, and in those cases, then we will look to mark them to market according to what the market thinks they're worth, even if the equity doesn't look like it's impaired. And so with the income portfolio, there's those two different lenses that we look through both to come to our valuations.
Okay, thank you. Tell me, are you still on the line?
Yes, I am, yeah.
Wonderful. Can you confirm to me that the board sets the buyback policy and the board is operating independently of the investment manager?
Yes, I can. I mean, the board does discover, not discover, the board does discuss buybacks. We also speak to the brokers. The buyback policy is not determined by the investment manager. As I have said today, we will shortly be in a position to engage in buybacks. That doesn't mean we are going to engage in buybacks. It simply means that the documentation will be in place there with Jefferies, as it was for many years. And of course, at one stage, we did buy back quite a lot of shares. And then for a number of years, the buyback documentation was not in place. That is being, you could use the word refreshed, updated. It's virtually there. And there are so many different considerations relating to share buybacks. But it is not determined by the investment manager. And I think it is very much incumbent on me to actually repeat that I have never come across any single example in which this investment manager has sought to influence the board relating to buybacks, either to buy back or not to buy back, from its own selfish perspective. It's always been a very honourable evaluation of what to do with shareholder funds, whether to invest them in the assets in which we do invest them, whether to pay them back as dividends to our shareholders, or whether to engage in share buybacks. And share buybacks is an option. It's shortly going to be a real option, simply in the sense that the documentation will be there in place. But it will be the board which will determine whether to buy or not to buy. And also, it is the board which will work out and approve those guidelines to the brokers, which will then authorize the brokers to engage in any share buybacks. But no, it's the board which will determine this. And I think that's all there is to be said at the moment. Share buybacks are one of those topics which excite a lot of emotion. I know I've spent, I don't know how many hundreds of hours over the last 14 years discussing them in various companies. Sometimes they've worked well enough, and sometimes they haven't.
Thank you.
Thank you, and I'm showing no further questions in the queue at this time. I'd like to turn the call back over to the speakers for any closing remarks.
Well, I'd just like to say thank you to everyone for joining today, and of course, we'll be providing further updates as the year goes on and into next year when we get to our full year evaluation. So thank you to everyone for joining today.
Ladies and gentlemen,
thank you also from me for the questions today. And despite the fact that times are so volatile, I'd like to wish you all a very happy Christmas, and hopefully in 2019 some of the problems which we all presently face will be less. So have a very, very happy Christmas, and thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This does conclude your program, and you may all disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.